In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the importance of animals in the lives of children, both real in the sense of pets and also imagined. And our guest of the program is Gail Melson. She's professor of child development and family studies at Purdue. And she's written a book on this subject. The title of her book is Why the Wild Things Are Animals in the Lives of Children. It's published by the Harvard University Press and explores the role that having animals around plays in the development of children, something that she says actually hadn't been explored very much previously. Surprising when you think about just how many American households have pets. And we'll explore the territory with her in the program this morning. And as always, of course, questions are welcome. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. Any place else around Illinois or Indiana, you could be in Lafayette and you could use the toll-free line and call in, and that would be 800-222-9455. So again, 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Well, Professor Melson, hello.
Hello. I'm delighted to be here.
I'm very pleased that you could talk with us. I think you note in the book that the studies that had been done previously, vast majorities of studies of child development, emphasized, and of course appropriately emphasized, the connections that children had with other human beings, with their parents, their relatives, their brothers and sisters, their friends, their teachers, on and on and on. But that this matter that you focus on in the book, that is children's relationships with animals, and the role that that might indeed play in their development, is something that psychologists and others hadn't spent much time thinking about or looking at. What was it that led you to want to explore the subject?
Well, it's interesting. I began very much reflecting the general absence of interest in animals. I began with a question that I was researching, more than a decade ago. I was interested in how caregiving, or what I called nurturing, develops in children. I felt the roots of being a sensitive caregiver that's so important in adulthood might begin in childhood. And as I was exploring that, focusing on how children responded to babies and other young humans, I noticed that there was a very marked gender difference, that boys and girls began to respond very differently to the whole idea of caregiving by the time they were 5 years old. And a colleague, as I remarked on this, said, why don't you look at pets? They are in households very frequently, and they need care. Perhaps children can get valuable experience in nurturing or caregiving from pets, and perhaps boys and girls might equally benefit from that. Mm-hmm. So that became a curious question in my mind. And as I began to explore that particular question, I realized quite quickly that pets were below the radar screen. Children's experiences with animals were simply not being studied in the mainstream of psychology.
And I think it's interesting that in an anecdotal sense, I think that people have a feeling that pets can have that function. If you had one growing up, maybe you know that. And then if you had one growing up and you have children, you think this would be a nice experience for my kids to have. And it might not be the case that you could be real articulate in describing why you think that it would be a nice experience. But almost on an emotional level, I think one has this idea that it would be a good experience. So it's sort of surprising that being there, that nobody, no one in a scholarly way had come along and said, well, gosh, that's pretty interesting. Why don't we actually take a close look at that?
At least very few scholars have been paying attention to the role of animals in children's development. And it's quite surprising, not only because, as you say, parents intuitively have a sense that this is a valuable experience for their children as they're growing up. But also we see that children are very interested in animals in such a multitude of ways that to ignore this in the study of children is, I argue, a very narrow interpretation of a child's environment.
Mm-hmm. Just going back to this issue of, and this may be jumping ahead a little bit, but this issue of gendering and how it is that little boys and little girls interact with other living things. People have done these studies with toddlers and young kids and babies, and have found that the girls take to the babies and almost become little moms, and that the boys, particularly once they get to be of a certain age, they seem hesitant. They're not that interested. And unless, of course, you believe that somehow this is hardwired, you have to think that it does have something to do with socialization. What's interesting, though, is then they will behave very differently with animals. That a little boy who would be very hesitant to pick up and cuddle a baby apparently would have no reservations about picking up and cuddling a puppy. And I think that that's both curious and interesting, and leads me to indeed think about what in these responses are conditions, what really has to do with socialization and what really is hardwired.
And that's something that has really intrigued us. And one of the things that we did in earlier studies, along with a colleague of mine, Alan Fogel, who was then at Purdue, we videotaped children as they interacted with babies, crawling babies around 8 months of age. And we videotaped children who were from 2.5 years old until 6 years of age. And we could demonstrate that under the age of 4, there were no gender differences. Boys and girls were really equally fascinated and interested in the babies. And the babies, of course, were very fascinated and interested in these older children. Babies really love to get some attention from older children. After the age of 4, we found the beginning of an emergence of this gender difference, with boys showing less interest and girls showing greater interest. So I think our research leans toward the socialization interpretation, because in the earlier years, we don't find that difference between boys and girls, and it only emerges after children have an idea. And they do seem to get this idea that caring for babies is, as one young child told me, a mommy thing, despite the fact that clearly they observe dads being very involved with child care these days. They nonetheless interpret caring for babies as something that is associated with the female role. And both boys and girls in preschool years and 4, 5, 6 years of age are very interested and concerned about what it means to be a boy and a girl, and they're getting their gender role ideas, and so we see this emerge.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, Gail Melson, is professor of child development and family studies at Purdue University, and we're talking about her book, Why the Wild Things Are, which looks at the place of animals in the lives of children, published by the Harvard University Press. And questions are certainly welcome. If you'd like to call in, have a question, comment, you may do that by dialing up the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Whichever one works best for you, you're certainly welcome into the conversation. There is a really striking statistic that I came across, and that has to do with just how many households have companion animals, that it is actually now more common that a child would grow up in a house with a pet than they would grow up in a house with both parents. That's a sort of startling sort of thing to contemplate.
It is, and actually we don't have as good statistics as we might about the presence of pets, because the U.S. Census doesn't, again, include them along with the enumeration of humans. But we have very good estimates from other surveys. And what we find is that households with children are actually the households most likely to have companion animals, more likely than households of adults living alone or adults-only households. So children very much go along with companion animals or pets, and they're actually more likely to be in the household than the continuous presence of both parents. Children spend part of their growing up years increasingly in a single parent household, although not necessarily the entire time.
You mentioned that some people believe that having a pet in the household is good because it gives children the experience of caring for another living thing, developing compassion with another living thing. Is it, given the fact now that there are many smaller families and that children are probably not, they're less likely to have a lot of siblings. In fact, they might not have any. Is it going too far to think that in some cases that that pet might be a stand-in for a brother or sister?
Well, as we've been interviewing children, often they talk about their pet in the same sort of language that they speak about a younger sibling. And I like to think of pets sometimes as fulfilling the role of siblings without the sibling rivalry, without the grappling for attention, you know, from parents. They're a kind of defanged and declawed younger sibling in some respects. But certainly pets can fulfill for children a wide variety of functions. And much does depend upon the family climate. So parents play an important role here in helping children get more out of their experience with pets or perhaps getting less out of it.
Hmm. Adults, certainly, if you ask them and they're being honest to people who have pets in their homes, will tell you, yes, it's true, I talk to them. And sometimes we talk to them as if they were capable of talking back. Children apparently do this as much of an adult as adults, but some children actually say that they do confide in their pets. That is, they're using them as a kind of a therapist, even though of course they can't respond. They certainly are capable of giving you deep and searching looks as if they understood what it was you were saying. Do you find that is indeed can be an important function of having the pet?
It seems to be one of the most important functions, both for children and adults. There have been surveys of adults in which 95% of them agree that they do speak to their pet, and a colleague of mine has said the other 5% are probably too embarrassed to admit it. So this is a very widespread phenomenon. In one study, we interviewed children making a transition into public school. They were entering kindergarten. And when we asked them, when you're feeling sad or angry, who do you turn to? We certainly expected that parents would be the overwhelming choice. And in fact, most children did say parents. But 42% of them said that they turned to their pet. And they not only hugged and cuddled, but they talked to their pet. So the fact that the animal can't talk back isn't necessarily a problem.
What other sorts of things do you think in terms of are important here, are going on here in terms of the emotional connection and how that is significant for children's development?
Well, I think one thing we haven't touched on is the development of empathy and what psychologists call perspective taking. We know that children, when they're very young, often have difficulty understanding different perspectives. They tend to be what Piaget called egocentric. They see the world from their own point of view. And one of the benefits that animals can give to children, again, I think under adult guidance, is understanding that there is a very different perspective on the world. This is obviously a different species. Needs to eat different food, has different needs for exercise, for sleep, for physical care. And so the child has to imaginatively put themselves in the paws of another creature. And this can be beneficial in terms of developing sensitivity to others. Eventually, we hope, sensitivity to other humans as well who have very different characteristics and needs from that of the child.
I think it's interesting that you point out that in in many other places, in other cultures, children, sometimes very young children, are involved in taking care of their siblings, their brothers and sisters. And it's something that here we really don't, for a number of reasons, we don't do. Perhaps part of the reason is that it's illegal, that it's actually against the law to leave little children in the care of older siblings if they're not grown up. And that one of the benefits, I think you argue one of the benefits of, again, pet ownership is that it gives children, young children, an opportunity to have some caretaking experience when they're involved in whatever has to be done for the puppy or the kitty or the guinea pig or, you know, whatever it is.
Yes, one of the things that's very interesting is looking at anthropological accounts of how children grow up in many different societies around the world. And there we see a phenomenon, anthropologists call it sibling caretaking, in fact, in which older brothers and sisters spend quite a bit of time when they are not in school. And in some societies, schooling is not available for all, but they spend quite a lot of time caring for younger brothers and sisters, even babies strapped around their back with a cloth. The child carries the baby around. And I remember spending some time in West Africa years ago and seeing this, 5 and 6 year olds carrying around their baby brothers and sisters. We certainly don't want to advocate that in our society, but it's interesting to think about the availability of caregiving, nurturing experiences for our children. And I argue that they are really quite limited, especially for boys, because of this gender effect that I mentioned earlier. So pets at least provide an opportunity. They're not the panacea, but they are at least an opportunity for children to learn about a relatively helpless creature who needs care, to learn what they need, to practice fulfilling the needs of another creature, and to gain some interest and confidence and skill, we hope, in nurturing others.
There has been some research on the therapeutic effect of having companion animals, and I think that it certainly the work has been done in adults, where you find out something as simple as just, you know, having a cat on your lap and sort of stroking the cat or petting the dog or whatever it is can have measurable effect. You can see in people that they become more relaxed, their, you know, their blood pressure goes down, all sorts of things that come under the heading of stress reduction. Has that sort of have people looked at how that works in children, and does indeed the same thing happen in children?
Well, there have been limited studies, but the ones that exist are very thought-provoking, I think. In one study, children were asked to read a poem while they had a dog in the room, not actually their own dog, and they didn't have the dog on their lap. They weren't petting it. The dog was just sitting in the room, and their blood pressure went down while the dog was present. When they were asked to do the very same thing when the dog was out of the room, their blood pressure went up. It turns out that reading and even talking to a good friend are activities that actually raise blood pressure. And we have found that being in the presence of an animal, a friendly animal, even in the same room as a fish tank, can lower blood pressure. And that is turning out to be a mode of stress reduction. In another study, observing a fish tank proved to be effective relaxant prior to undergoing dental surgery and was compared with meditation and with the administration of drugs, found to be equally effective in this study with adults. So I think we have very intriguing evidence that I hope will stimulate much more research.
We have a caller to talk with, someone calling on a car phone, so we'll get right to them on our line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Yes.
Hello.
I hope you can hear me. I'm heading into Indiana, but I'm listening to the show, and it's very interesting. I wanted to comment on the statement you made about American families not necessarily training their children to take care of their siblings, and I'm wondering to what extent that's a class question, because some poor and working class families have to rely on, they actually raise their children to look out for each other. And I know we always hear the story that makes the news about, you know, a 10-year-old who was at home watching the kids and the fire started. But, I mean, there are lots of cases of families who just have to do that for reasons of economics. They can't afford child care. But the larger point I wanted to make is that some of those children really do have an early sense of nurturing another human being. They don't have pets, but they have siblings that they have to take care of.
I think...
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes.
I think that the caller's point is certainly very well taken. She's certainly correct in that, I think.
I think it's an excellent point. And one of the issues that I address in the book is not so much the involvement of siblings, and clearly that is greater when there is economic necessity, but the fact that our society does not value and provide supportive structures around sibling caregiving. It's seen as something that is unfortunately necessary when there is not other economic alternatives. And yet, it's valued as an important learning experience in other cultures.
Yeah.
So I think that's the difference.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you for the call. And others are certainly welcome. You have questions, comments, like to share your thoughts with us, you can give us a call. Our guest, I should introduce her again, Gail Melson. She's professor of child development and family studies at Purdue University and is the author of the book, Why the Wild Things Are, Animals in the Lives of Children. It's published by the Harvard University Press. And calls are welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Another of the things that you report in the book is that apparently the vast majority of America's children, something like between 80 and 90%, first confront the loss of a loved one when a pet dies or disappears. And you note certainly it's true that we're rather insulated from both birth and death. It's just not the kind of thing that we have the opportunity to witness. And I wonder whether you think, in fact, that it may be strange to make the argument that way or make this point that way, but that is another way in which the pet might perform an important function.
I think that's very true. When we look at how much children are exposed to the experience of birth and death, as you say, we are very isolated as a culture. Children are shut away from both of those experiences in terms of humans. They have more access, not a great deal, but more access to understanding the process of birth and death, which after all are part of life, in terms of their observations of animals, perhaps small common wild animals that are found around their house and neighborhood, but also companion animals. Clearly, we don't want our beloved pets to die ever, but they do, hopefully, of a very advanced old age. And this is an experience that can help children, again, I think, with proper parental support, understand what brackets life, both birth and death. Hmm.
I think we have another caller here getting lined up. This is Bloomington, Indiana, and our toll-free line number 4. Hello.
Hi. May I add to what the last caller said? She was talking about the fact that sibling care is often needed. But, you know, it's important that sibling care is not only needed, but when children can perform a role in the home, it should be recognized as important. Oftentimes, I think one of the biggest problems in family life today is that children are viewed as having no role. They are simply a nuisance. But when a child can care for the other children, or when he can keep the house, do the dishes, perform all kinds of chores around, that gives the child a value. And a real economic value. Child's no longer a nuisance, but a real asset. And I think that contributes to family. That, you know, that's how children used to be. When they'd grow up on farms, and by the time they were 11, 12, 13 years old, they were running the farm. And the parents really valued them. Every child was valued. The more children you had, the richer you were, because every one of those children were workers. that we've almost lost that concept of the valued child. Now, if we could get some actual work for the child to do that would be very much valued and needed, we would be benefited.
Well, that's just a hair off the subject, but Professor Melson, you want to comment on that?
Well, I think it's an interesting point. We tend to think of children as sort of a vessel we pour our resources into, and especially as family size decreases, parents have one or perhaps two children. Children are almost designer products for those in the upper middle class. And they're seen as recipients of care, I argue, rather than caregivers, or, as this caller says, contributors to the family and the household. And in a funny way, that may diminish their value, even as they're being the recipients of more and more designer products. So I do think there's a point there that we need to recognize the contributions that children can make that are appropriate for their developmental level.
Other questions again, welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Our guest is Gail Melson. She teaches at Purdue. She's professor of child development and family studies. And we're talking about some of the things in her book that look at the significance of animals in the lives of children, Why the Wild Things Are, is the title of the book. One of the things that you did was you set out to look for places where there are animals in school settings. And probably a lot of places there are classrooms that do have some variety of wildlife, some more than others. And it can be a little problematic. But also, I think some teachers have found that it's can be very, very useful to incorporate the animals in specific sorts of learning situations, but maybe also just generally in the classroom environment.
Yes, and we've found some teachers really can structure even a whole curriculum around the presence of classroom animals or classroom pets. They can use it not only to help children understand responsibility and caregiving, but as an adjunct to learning the basics, the three R's. In one of the classrooms, we observed children selected books about their favorite animal, wrote reports, used measuring out food and that kind of thing as part of their math lessons. This reflected the enthusiasm of that particular teacher. And clearly not all teachers are equally enthusiastic, nor do they need to be, frankly, but it can be a very valuable learning tool. And we found that children in classrooms with classroom animals appear to be highly motivated to relate to them and to engage in learning tasks around them.
I think it's interesting because I would imagine that some people, their initial reaction would be, well, the animals just would be a distraction.
That's true. And interestingly enough, we found quite the opposite, that these animals are, if skillfully integrated into a classroom, and I think that's an important point, but if skillfully integrated, they can be a motivator for learning. Also, teachers tell us that children can use a timeout, if you will, with an animal, perhaps just holding the classroom rabbit for a few seconds, as an important source of reassurance and relaxation. It's pretty stressful for kids to be a long day in a classroom as we increase the competencies we demand and our standardized testing. This isn't necessarily a relaxed, fun environment, and pets humanize that in an interesting way.
A little bit earlier, we were talking about some of the research that had been done that shows that the presence of animals can have, for adults at least, can have a therapeutic effect. Certainly it can have a calming effect. And maybe people have heard about the kind of things that have been done where, for example, the dogs and cats were taken into places like nursing homes. And that people with various kinds of physical and mental disabilities in an amazing way respond to the animals in a way that they would not, perhaps could not or would not respond to other human beings even. One area that you explore is the possibility of using animals as a part of a therapy with children who have various kinds of difficulties. What sort of work has been done there?
Well, there are some excellent facilities which have really been models, demonstrations for this kind of approach. The one that's perhaps the best known is called Green Chimneys Children's Services, and this is in Brewster, New York, about an hour north of New York City. This is a residential treatment facility for seriously emotionally disturbed children. The majority of these children have had a psychiatric inpatient hospitalization, which is something that indicates quite a serious disturbance. Green Chimneys utilizes a therapeutic approach that integrates animals and, in fact, horticulture or nature therapy as part of the milieu of treatment. They are located on a farm-like campus. Children help to care for farm animals. They do hippo therapy or horseback riding therapy. They learn to ride horses. They have dogs who are in their residential areas. Animals are everywhere, and they are used as part of the treatment. Some children who find it very difficult to confide in a therapist are seen talking to one of these animals. And that gets back to this notion that we spoke of earlier, that people tend to confide and speak to animals.
Yeah. And there seems to, perhaps one of the benefits does seem to be, and it's the same kind of benefit that I think anybody experiences with a companion animal, and that is unconditional love. I think here in that section you say one of the social workers told you that animals don't read the child's chart. They don't care about his history. So all of that sort of baggage that would come there in the relationship with another human, with an animal, you just don't have that.
There certainly is a sense and that animals are non-judgmental, totally accepting. And the more interactive species, such as dogs who are sort of gazing at you with those big brown eyes, certainly give us that feeling. We may not know exactly what the dog is thinking, but we feel as though our deepest thoughts are being heard.
I think it's quite interesting to this particular setting, the ones where contact with nature, living things, and not just animals, but also plants and so forth, seems to have this benefit. Why do you think it works? If it does indeed work, why do you think it works?
Well, one of the hypotheses that I explore, and I do think it's a hypothesis, we can't be sure, is called the biophilia hypothesis. And this gets back to your notion of hardwiring. The idea here is that the human species evolved in an environment of plants and animals, and of course our very survival depends upon both the plant and animal world. And so the human species evolved to be especially attuned to life forms, to plants and animals, and that is indeed hardwired into our brain. We prefer to gaze out on a grove of trees rather than a sidewalk with some oil towers or even some high-rise buildings, because we may not be able to articulate why it makes us feel good to gaze at the ocean or gaze at the woods, but it is, biophilia hypothesis suggests, because the human species has evolved to have this characteristic, this attunement to other forms of life. There was a fascinating study done by Roger Ulrich, a investigator at the University of Texas. He showed that if you have cardiac patients recovering in a hospital where their window looks out on a grove of trees, they will leave the hospital earlier than the same patients with the same illness recovering in adjacent rooms looking out at an alley. So there's an actual measurable physical effect of being surrounded by nature and by animals, and we can see that in blood pressure changes and in recovery from cardiovascular disease.
Well, it's interesting to see that there's a scientific verification for that, because I guess that's another one of those things that people would say, well, we don't need to do a study to tell us that. But I suppose there is something, some bit of reassurance in the fact that there is a study that says, and we're not just imagining that this effect, that it actually is, in fact.
And I think the documentation is important because think of the implications for architecture and for design of facilities such as hospitals and schools and nursing homes. If, in fact, it's important for humans to have this contact with green living things, with other species, then we would be mindful of that when we are designing facilities, especially for people under stress.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, and I want to introduce again the guest. Gail Melson is professor of child development and family studies at Purdue University. And her book is Why the Wild Things Are. It looks at the significance of animals in the lives of children. It's published by the Harvard University Press. It's out fairly recently, so if you're interested, you can seek it out. It should be available in the bookstore if you want to take a look at it. And we are here open to your questions also. Here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one is good any place you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana, anywhere that signal will travel. That's 800-222-9455. And we have another caller here up in Aurora, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, hi. I turned into your program rather late, I'm sorry to say. I have a granddaughter that moved in from another state, and she didn't want to move, and she doesn't want to stay here. And she has a collection of animals, and I always sort of realized that they would be therapeutic for her. She has 3 cats, a dog, a bird, about 10 goldfish, and a guinea pig, and wants a snake. So I realized that she really wanted those and needed those, but when do you say no to the next animal?
That's an interesting question. How old is your daughter?
This is my granddaughter.
Your granddaughter. How old is she?
She's 9.
She's 9. And are these animals placing a burden on her family?
On her mother.
On her mother?
Yeah.
And what is that burden?
Cleaning the kitty litter, which I have tried to help because I know the cats can be very therapeutic. You know, I just know cats, especially one of the cats they have. He is just really a nice cat. And so I try to clean the kitty litter once a week anyway and bring in my own boxes of to replace the dirty. And so I've tried to help in that. And, but, you know, cats need space. And in the spring, they want to go out of doors. So that makes a problem because one is a bird killer. And the snake, well, that's a lot to take care of a snake.
Right. And you're really raising some issues that we haven't addressed yet. Keeping animals is a very important responsibility, and there is expense that's associated with it.
Expense, yes, to feed a 70-pound German Shepherd.
That's right.
At least $50 a month.
That's right. So part of the benefits for children, I would argue, is not only opportunities to nurture, not only the therapeutic value, but the teaching of responsibility. A child of 9 can certainly understand the expenses, the chores that are involved with an animal, and can understand whether this is in the best interest of the family or not. And that's an important lesson. So that
there are lessons to be learned, but sometimes they come very slowly.
Absolutely.
between.
Absolutely. But I would say, you know, without knowing the individuals, that just adding more pets isn't necessarily in the benefit of a child. And learning more about the responsibility of caring for the pets that one has might be more beneficial.
Yeah, but it is very good for the children. And it's But a parent has to have a lot of patience and a lot of money.
Absolutely. You know, we know that this is another responsibility for the life of the animal, and there are expenses.
Yeah, and vet charges are very high
exactly.
these days. They're very, very high. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go on to someone here locally in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. I was just wondering if you could maybe address more the responsibilities of owning pets, but also maybe some things about the animal's perspective as far as their interaction in terms of the issues that you're bringing up. One of the concerns that I have is that if there's kind of a prescriptive notion to what you're talking about, animals that may potentially be adopted and then relinquished because people lose interest in them or the child outgrows them, I think it's real risky to talk about the value that a child can learn from observing the birthing process of animals when those animals mm-hmm. ultimately end up as unwanted and end in already overburdened shelters. So could you talk about those things?
Absolutely, yeah. And I don't mean to advocate not neutering or spaying
right.
animals. I think that's enormously important and is part of what children need to understand is responsible pet ownership. You know, one of the things that is important, I think, that children learn from having animals is they are learning about the respect that is due to other species. So clearly, when parents have impulse purchases of animals or have not thought through the fact that this must be a commitment for the lifetime of this animal, the natural lifetime of this animal, then what they are certainly teaching their child something, and it's about the disposability of inconvenient family members. And that's precisely not the kind of lesson that I would assume parents would want to teach their children. So the responsibility and commitment to animal ownership needs to be very carefully thought through. The other issue that as we see animals being increasingly used in therapeutic settings and in classroom settings are issues related to animal welfare. And I think this must be front and center. A teacher may find that it's wonderful for the classroom atmosphere to have a hamster or a rabbit in a cage, but that teacher has not thought through what happens during school vacations,
exactly.
what happens during the summer, what happens in terms of the issue of zoonotic diseases and the cleanliness issues of children who will reach their hands in and then not necessarily wash them. So all of those issues have to be carefully thought through, and no teacher should acquire classroom animals, again, in an impulsive way without having thought those things through. I do think, though, that animals can provide an increased appreciation, that children can develop that increased appreciation for the rights, the respect that other species are due when they see animals treated in a respectful way.
Yes. Yeah, I think there's enormous merit to the things that you're describing, and am involved in some groups locally that are attempting those things. I think, as you have just described, we need to also be cautious about what are the best benefits for the animal as well in this collaboration, in this process.
Absolutely. And, you know, I've been in touch with many animal-assisted therapy programs, and they're wonderful from many perspectives, but I find that the concerns about animal welfare is a therapy dog, for example, being stressed or being, quote, overused by repeated visits to a children's hospital. Those issues have to be very much front and center so that we must be able to say that this is not harming and perhaps is helping the animal. We have to be careful that we are not using animals as tools, and I think that undermines the benefit for children.
Right, as well as intentioned as it may be become just another exploitation of the species.
Exactly. And that itself is the lesson that we are trying not to teach children.
Exactly.
So it becomes self-defeating. I think that's absolutely correct.
Right. Thank you very much. It's very valuable work.
Thank you. It's certainly very important points. I think in, you know, in the many shows that we've done with vets and with animal trainers, I think we've always tried to talk about responsible pet ownership and say things like, you know, an animal should never be given as a gift. It shouldn't be a surprise. And when you think about taking an animal into your home, you do need to think about what your life is like and how that animal will fit in, and to try to be prepared to make a good home for that animal, for and know that you're making a commitment that could last a long time.
Exactly. It's very important.
Well, we're going to have to stop here. We have somebody I can't take. I'm sorry, we're just out of time, but I want to mention again that if you're interested in reading on this subject, you can look for the book we've mentioned. It's titled Why the Wild Things Are, Animals in the Lives of Children, published by the Harvard University Press by our guest Gail Melson from Purdue. Professor Melson, thanks very much for talking
with us. Thank you. It's been a delightful experience.